Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Elizabeth Broderick makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She's been here on quite a few times before, talking on matters such as investing in care, on aged care, on age discrimination, on sex discrimination, and various other matters. She was, I should point out, she graduated in arts and law. She worked in law for Blake Dawson Waldron in Australia, for another company in Britain, and was appointed by the Howard government as the Sex Discrimination Commissioner. For a while that included responsibilities for AIDS discrimination, and she was reappointed by the Rudd-Gillard Labor government and is currently the Sex Discrimination Commissioner, and very well known for her role in there and for her public appearances. But tonight Ms. Broderick's going to talk to us on the topic, women in the Australian Defence Force. Elizabeth Broderick, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard. And it's always great to come back to the Sydney Institute. I can't remember when I first addressed it. I know my parents have been long-time supporters of the Sydney Institute, and I probably came when I was a much younger person than I am now, when you were just first starting off. So it's a great privilege to be back here with Anne and Gerard to talk about something that's a bit different this time, and that is to look at women in the Australian Defence Force. I want to start by acknowledging that we're meeting on traditional lands and to pay my respects to elders past and present. Well, the road that's brought me here today has been a fascinating one. It's one that I've found incredibly rewarding. And I'd been the Sex Discrimination Commissioner for about 3.5 years before I was formally asked to conduct a review into the treatment of women in Australia, the Australian Defence Force Academy, which is the academy, but also more broadly across the Australian Defence Force. Now, I knew right from the beginning the task wouldn't be easy. Indeed, at times it felt overwhelming. But the challenge was to work closely with the ADF to transform what some would say is the most hyper-masculine culture in Australia, the warrior culture, into a more inclusive culture. One that didn't lose the essence of warrior, because that's very important in a combat fighting force, but one that in which both men and women could serve as equal partners. And whilst I was very familiar with the issues around sex discrimination, around women in leadership, flexible work, sexual harassment, sexual abuse, I was a novice when it came to all things military. So that was the very first thing that I decided, that if we were to commence the review, if we were to be of value to the Australian Defence Force, but also to the Australian community, we needed to learn as much about defence and each of the individual services as we possibly could. So that's what we set out to do. And in 2.5 years now, we've really immersed ourselves deeply in Defence Force culture. So to date, just to give you an idea about that, we've visited around 60 military establishments, and that's not just in Australia. We've been up beyond the wire in the forward operating bases in Afghanistan and across the Middle East. We have been in warships, submarines, in Black Hawks, fixed wing aircraft, in tanks, across training, exercises, naval, air force and army environments. And we've spoken to well over 3,000 members of the Australian Defence Force individually. And we have also analysed reams of documents. I have to say, and I'm sure Kate from the ADF being here will agree with me, that the ADF is very good on policies. So we've reamed, we've analysed literally hundreds and hundreds of policies and practices, and we have conducted surveys with many members of the Australian Defence Force, over 6,000 there, around issues such as leadership, work and family, sexual harassment and sexual abuse, career progression and discrimination. So whilst I don't claim to know everything there is to know about ADF culture, and the microcultures that exist, I do believe that the experience that my team and I have had over the last 2.5 years place me in a very good a position to observe the areas where the culture's really working well, but also to offer some suggestions about areas for improvement. The research has been rigorous and robust, and the analysis and the observations that we make are on the basis of a thorough analysis of the quantitative and qualitative data. So they're not just things that we think might be a good idea, they're very evidence-based. I want to say right at the outset that the work I've done has been both a priority and a privilege. It's been a priority because the equal treatment of women should be at the core of any Australian workplace, whether it's the military or any of the workplaces that we're involved in. And the ADF, as one of Australia's largest employers and an important source of employee training and development, in fact, you may not know, but the ADF is the largest registered training organisation in Australia. So what happens in the ADF matters. It's a nation-building enterprise. It's also been a privilege to engage with the unique nature of our Defence Force and to hear firsthand that deep commitment to service, to protect the well-being and security of our nation. And I have to say, you know, I've met so many impressive people across the ADF, some of the most impressive Australians I've met, both men and women, and from each of the different services. So to that extent, it's been a real privilege. You don't see that level of psychological commitment to an organisation in civilian organisations. I just don't see it, but I see it in the ADF. And in fact, last month I was up in Talisman Sabre, which is a joint US-Australian exercise, training exercise, where once again I observed up close and personal, from my hoochie in the middle of central Australia to on a warship out in the Coral Sea, but to really observe a professionalism, diligence and enthusiasm of our forces. So that's the context in which the review happened. And when I first began the review, so many people said to me, look, the leaders of the ADF will be insular, they won't be accommodating to an outsider, you're not going to learn anything, you're not going to hear anything. And I have to say, that couldn't be further from the truth. The Chief of Defence Force, the Vice Chief, each of the Chiefs of the Services and beyond have given us unprecedented access into the ADF. So wherever we've asked to go, that has been facilitated. And it's been facilitated quickly and where appropriately sensitively. So I have to say, the access and our ability to go in has been terrific. So what I want to do today is talk to you about the equal treatment of women in the Australian Defence Force. I want to talk to you about the case for change, why the ADF, why the Australian community needs to care about this issue. But I also want to share with you some of the experiences with the senior leaders of a Defence Force, how they came to see change as critical and what they're doing now to progress the cultural change. So as a Human Rights Commissioner, I believe that all people should be treated equally. That's including in their workplace. And I'm sure many of you will agree with that as a starting proposition. Everyone has the right to be treated with dignity and respect, to be given equal opportunity to develop their career. And that message was relatively easy to take into the ADF senior leadership. But there are other reasons that we need to care, and these are the reasons that when I'm working, particularly down the mid-rank levels, I don't so much position it as a human rights issue. It's very much around capability and cost. But before I go on to that, let me give you a couple of the compelling statistics from my report. And what you'll see there is, in terms of a talent pool, this is a pool of talent that the ADF draws on. Now, in fact, the ADF uses what we call ab initio recruitment. That is, we recruit very early on and we grow our people. And I have to say, some of the leadership development is the best that I've ever seen. But they work from a pool which is usually men in the age group 17 to 24. Now, we know that talent pool is flatlining because of declining fertility rates. And not only that, it's mining companies, the NBN, everyone else who's drawing from that same talent pool. So that talent pool is absolutely shrinking. But As well as that, 80% of ADF personnel are men who speak English at home. That represents less than 40% of the talent that exists in Australia. And the ADF has struggled to meet its recruiting targets for the past decade or so. In fact, in some occupations, it's struggled to fill 50% of the available roles. That's the first thing. The second thing is, in the last decade, there's only been a 1% increase in the number of women, or in the proportional representation of women in the ADF. Now, that's at a time, if you look at the last two decades, 1.6 million new female entrants came into the labour market. And what you can see is that, yes, a lot of them would have chosen to go to defence, but they went to defence at pretty much the same rate that they were leaving. Women comprise about 13.9%. That just shows you the numbers, and there we've kind of pretty much tailed out there at around 13.9% of all ADF personnel. If you look at officers, that's 17.4%, and if you look at other ranks, that's the general enlistment, it's at 12.6%. Women make up about 18% of Navy, 10% of Army and 17% of Air Force. And they're very underrepresented across most areas, at senior leadership level particularly, within the organisation. I just want to show you that. If you look at that, women make up less than 5% of star ranks, of star or general ranks, and less than 8% of warrant officers, which are the senior non-commissioned officers. And interestingly, around that also, if you look at the group of women who are at the most senior levels, we did a detailed analysis of the top 200 leaders in the ADF. Around 90% of the men would have children. Less than 20% of the women will have children. So that's the cultural message. If you want to achieve and grow your career, particularly as a woman, then family is not necessarily part of that picture. And the other thing I'd say is 1 in 4 women and 1 in 10 men experienced sexual harassment in the ADF in the last 5 years. Now, interestingly, that's about exactly the same as have experienced in the civilian population, because we did for the first time an aggregate survey between sexual harassment in the military vis-a-vis sexual harassment in the aggregate of all civilian organisations. And interestingly, the prevalence data is almost identical. What is different is people's propensity to speak out, and also the severity of some of that sexual harassment. Let's then look at the question of cost and capability. I mean, if we look at cost, the fact is that my review found that the ADF recruitment costs have tripled over the last, say, few years. In 2001, it cost $7,000 per enlistment. In 2010, it was $22,000. And more roles have traditionally, the ones that have been held by women, have been civilianised as well. So a lot of those feminine areas, such as hospitality, administration, have been contracted out, which once again is having an impact on some of the ADF figures and may also speak to the slow growth of women within the ADF more generally. But if we just look at the cost, the fact is the ADF invests in an average member between $580,000 and $680,000. You know, there's a significant investment in training. And if you're a fast jet pilot or a pilot of any type, or, you know, other senior officer, that's around $2 million. So unwanted departures are a huge cost to the ADF. In fact, in 2011, the total cost of turnover for the ADF was about $1.5 billion, up from an indicative figure of $1.1 billion the previous year, so trending upwards. So the fact is that any strategies to reduce separation rates and increase recruitment are absolutely critical to the ADF's cost effectiveness. And that's important because if I'm Liz Broderick and I ask for a flexible work arrangement when I'm 30 and that's not available, then when I leave, that has a significant cost. And not only that, unlike most civilian organisations, we'll just put another Liz Broderick with the same skills in. No, in the ADF, we have to have grown that person up from ab initio recruitment. So the strategies around this need to be very targeted, and for me, when I went in there, it's very much about the fact that members should not be required to sacrifice what I call basic human rights. Your right to family, your right to a work environment free from sexual violence. Women and men, for that matter, will be attracted to a workforce that allows them to have at least some balance between their personal life and the career opportunities, and a workplace that is inclusive. So it does have a cost. The other thing is, what about capability? Because when we go in, we very much link the increase in the representation of women to capability. And let me talk about that. In the ADF today, there's an increased focus on technology and problem solving. Modern military workplaces are complex and they're constantly evolving. So they require new and additional skills and adaptability rather than, in the past, maybe a greater reliance on physical strength. And it's interesting, with women coming into infantry and special forces, part of that's also a recognition that technology is making those roles more accessible to women. But some commentators note this so-called changing battlefield, which is observing that intelligence collecting, outreach to local populations, for instance, work where women are essential, will grow in importance, while remote work through technology becomes increasingly possible. And it's interesting, the Chief of Army tells the story of when he was up in Afghanistan and he was asked, why is it that we need women in infantry? And he said, well, can I ask you, how many of you have spoken to an Afghan woman in the time that you've been out beyond the wire? And not surprisingly, the answer was zero, because of cultural impediments of men speaking to women as well. And he said, well, that's really one of the reasons we need women as part of this, as part of our picture, because to be able to provide human security for the entire population requires us to understand the needs of the entire population, and that's about being able to communicate with them. But I think the most important thing for the ADF around capability is understanding that a sustainable workforce strategy comes from maximising the talent that can be attracted to the ADF. And if you look at the skills that are required to engage in future theatres of war, and there we're talking about cyber warfare, we're talking about urban warfare, counterinsurgency, over time, unless we pick up new skills, our defence forces, and this is militaries all around the world, will become less and less effective. So today's defence force demands adaptability, strategic thinking, working in small teams with minimal direction, remote work, intelligence gathering and outreach to local populations. And that requires both men and women. What I'd like to now talk about is what the review found. So the review found that the low number and seniority of women could impact on the ADF's future capability and operational effectiveness, and we've seen part of a picture to that. But let me show you what our evidence showed. It shows that women are exiting the ADF at higher rates than men through the recruiting pipeline. That they leave at particular stages in their career, and the data show that these attrition points actually align with times when women are seeking to establish a family. And that's particularly the case in Navy, because with Navy, childbearing pretty much directly overlaps with the requirement for seagoing. And when you think about it, often you'll be at sea for many months on end. So the ability to have a young family and to engage fully, particularly at sea, can be very, very difficult for women. That's when we see a huge number of women actually step out of the Navy. Even if you do step out, so a significant proportion of women who will take paid leave and some will take unpaid maternity leave, they will, many of them, separate from the ADF within the first 12 months of going back. And there is a very rigid career continuum. In the ADF, you need to have that tick in that box and that one and that one and that one and that one to have that job there. And often you need to do that in a time continuum. So I always say to the team, I've never seen a group of women who actually plan their conception down to the day as I have in the ADF. And part of that is I need to be through staff college or whatever it is to go through that promotional gateway. And so finally, women leave the military because of experiences of sexual harassment, sometimes sexual abuse, and for some of them an unsatisfactory response that they may have received when they actually raise this issue. So these were the key factors in the case for change that I took to the senior leaders, and I have to say they were eager for reform. Proposals for reform. I mean, they are committed and engaged to actually changing this picture. And in fact, the chiefs, and you can see that's a very attractive picture there, but I think, you know, I have to say, having worked with each of them for over 2.5 years now, I know there is a deep commitment to change. As they say, women are essential to the sustainability and operational effectiveness of the ADF, because they contribute to a diverse workforce which strengthens the ADF's ability to be an effective, modern, relevant and high-performing organisation. But before I take you through some of the changes that have resulted, what I do want to do is talk to you about another important element in making the case for change to the chiefs. And this had to do with the personal stories of the women I spoke to during my visits to the ADF bases. So as you saw at the beginning, we travelled to around 60 different military installations. And often on these visits, women would approach me one-on-one, many of them to talk to me about the experiences, the really positive experiences that they'd had in people supporting their flexible work arrangements and other things like that. But I have to say, on occasion, I did hear deeply distressing stories, personal stories of sexual harassment, bullying and sexual assault. And for many women, they'd never disclosed these stories before. And during some very distressing interviews, it occurred to me that, yes, it was important that as the Sex Discrimination Commissioner, that my team and I heard these stories. But what was more important was that the good men in the organisation who had the power to create change heard these stories, and that they heard firsthand these personal narratives. So not only did they hear the case for change, they were able to feel the case for change. So armed with this intent and aided by courageous women with compelling stories, what I did was arrange for each of the chiefs to spend time standing in the shoes of the most vulnerable, to stand in the shoes of those people who loved the ADF as much as they did, but for whom service had come at an unacceptable personal cost. And I flew in women from all over Australia, many who brought their mothers or other close personal support, so that really the chiefs could hear what extreme exclusion feels like, what it's like to be on exercise for several months when no one speaks to you, what it's like to be sexually assaulted by your instructor, who's the very person you turn to for advice, what it's like to having to face a perpetrator every day, even though you've reported his assault to your superiors. And most importantly, what it's like to have your career ruined because you had the courage to make a complaint. So I needed those chiefs, the very men with the power to create systemic change, to really listen deeply, to understand, and most importantly, to feel a deep personal commitment to change. Question is, would it work? I mean, military and emotion are not necessarily words that's sitting very close in a sentence. But I still remember that first to-face session, the service chief sitting uncomfortably in his chair, the mother nervously escorting her daughter into the room, a box of tissues in the middle. And the question was, where to begin? How would we kick this conversation off? But it was that courageous young woman who turned to the chief, and she said, "Sir, I am so very nervous." And the chief replied, "Believe me, I'm scared too." And I thought in that moment, we've really got a chance at change here. It takes an authentic and compassionate military leader to admit that he's fearful about what is about to be told, and to admit that he's prepared to listen deeply and to create change. And most importantly for me as a mother, the chiefs heard the pain of mothers. Mothers who had encouraged their daughters into the service, fervently believing that the enemy lay outside, not within. And as one mother said, she said to the chief, she said, "Look, I gave you the person I love most in the world, and this is how you've treated her." And at the end of these sessions, and I have to say without exception, to hear those really senior men stand up and say, look, if I could stand in your shoes every day and take away your pain, I'd choose to do that. What happened to you should never have happened in Australia's military. I will do everything I can to make sure it never happens again. And for most people, that's what they want. They want to hear that what happened to them was not right, and that it is validated through someone who has power to create change in the system. So when I look back, I think those were the defining moments of the review, and they're the moments when, for me, I started to understand that even in the most traditional and conservative organisations, that when you engage both the head and the heart, that's when you get transformational change. So when the recommendations for reform were released, and that was in August last year, August 2012, that report was tabled in the Parliament. The good news was that the military, and that's the Chief of Defence Force, the Vice Chief, and even the Chiefs, together with the government, and in fact bipartisan support, accepted the recommendations immediately. And they really have demonstrated a genuine, steadfast commitment to bring about cultural change in each of the three services. And, you know, I look every day and I'm just seeing so much change that's occurring. Army, for instance, have done a number of things. They've set a recruitment target, and the current Chief of Army, Lieutenant General David Morrison, is hoping to lift the recruitment of women by 2%, which doesn't sound like much, but given we've gone up 1% in the previous decade, that's a significant amount. So they have implemented a targeted strategy for recruiting more women, a try before you buy approach that's already seen results with more women signing up. So that's just one thing, and they've done many other things. Navy is really focused on that flexible work element. How can we make it possible for women to stay and also have families? And it's not just about women, it's about men as well. So alternative crewing models, a whole range of quite innovative strategies there. Air Force is implementing some temporary special measures for women in non-traditional employment roles, particularly female pilots, and they've really put in some bold strategies in that area. And greater attention is given to women who now come up to the promotion boards who may have taken some maternity leave or been in a flexible work arrangement, and that would have previously made them uncompetitive for promotion. So those things are actually being looked at. All services are now focusing on the supports needed for men in for women in very male-dominated industries, because I have to say, for a lot of the women that with the distressing stories, they were the first woman in this area, the first beyond here, the first there. So what are the peer supports for women who are going into very male-dominated industries? And for the ADF really to understand that the success of its strategy should not sit on the shoulders of women themselves. It actually has to sit with the whole teams and units. And particularly when I look at women coming into combat, the success of that strategy needs to be on a mixed gender team. But I just want to finish by talking about one of the most innovative, bold reforms that I think the ADF has embraced, and that is SEMPRO. So SEMPRO was perhaps our most significant recommendation in our whole report, and it was one that was immediately taken up by the ADF. As I indicated earlier, we did, as we went around, we came aware that victims of sexual assault and sexual misconduct were not reporting incidents, and as such, they weren't getting support. One of the reasons they weren't reporting is the only option for them was to report up the chain of command. And if it's someone in the chain of command that's sexually harassing you, then that's not really a very palatable option. Also, the shame associated with being a victim of a sexually related matter, together with a very strong culture of not complaining in the Defence Force, meant that these victims were often dealing with trauma silently and alone. We found that the ones that did go on to report incidents were often not getting the support they needed, and sometimes it wasn't just the incident that was traumatic, they were being re-traumatised by the handling of that incident. So SEMPRO was launched to really address these issues. And it's very much around a victim-centric approach. So before it was very much, let's track down these perpetrators. Now it's a recognition that victims of sexual assault, whether they be female or male, actually need support right from the very beginning, and that those who are disclosed are provided with the best advice possible. The most important thing about SEMPRO is now I can either report incidents up through the chain of command, if I'm happy to do that, or immediately I can take it outside the chain of command and take it to SEMPRO, where I will put in what's called a restricted report. That is, I don't want any investigation. What I want is medical support, counselling, some forensic support. But I am able to make a confidential report. And other militaries that have done this have found that the number of reports have increased often up to 100% in a very short period of time. So SEMPRO is about ensuring what's best for the victim and minimising trauma. It's headed by a one-star general, which is very important because it gives it a level of credibility in the organisation, which otherwise might not be there. So the review completed in 2012, and now our terms of reference require us to go back in and to 12 months after the tabling of that report to see what the military are doing with our recommendations. And I have to say, although it's still early days, progress certainly has been made across a number of areas. There's a fierce commitment by senior leadership and other agents of change to cultural change. There's a recognition of a critical link between women's representation and capability, and therefore operational effectiveness. And I think there's a general acceptance that the previous rates of attrition by both men and women cannot be endured in the current fiscal environment. This is how the three chiefs have seen some of the issues, and you may have seen Lieutenant General David Morrison. He also did a short video, which you may have seen from YouTube, really talking about how he sees a band of brothers and sisters in the military. I know it's almost gone viral, but here, as David says, Army's culture has tended to exclude women, and some ethnic groups are underrepresented in our ranks. This will prove unsustainable with demographic change over the next few decades. Harnessing the full potential of our workforce is a capability issue rather than a diversity issue for me, and I want to remove any artificial impediments to the best use of all our people. The Chief of Navy, Vice Admiral Ray Griggs, who's spoken regularly about this, but for him very much unacceptable behaviour towards women means our capability is degraded and our ability to achieve our mission is compromised. And the Chief of Air Force, Air Marshal Jeff Brown, who's also done a lot of work, says the true measure of an Air Force capability is not its machines, but its people. People get the most out of machines, not the other way around. And if we are to maximise our current and future capabilities, we must have a diverse, competent and sustainable workplace that has an inclusive and safe work environment. So the enduring challenge, as I see it, for the ADF, is to ensure that the commitment to cultural change is understood and accepted by all members within the organisation. And when you look at it, there's 60,000 members of the permanent ADF and another 40,000 in reserves and other related areas. So we're talking 100,000 there. And when I think about it, it's most important that this change is understood by mid-ranking personnel. So those members at mid-ranking level are the NCOs and junior officers, the sergeants, the majors. They're the keepers of a culture in the ADF. They have a direct influence on those who they lead now and in the future. And as I often say when I'm talking to them, your leadership and conduct shapes the attitudes and behaviours of all those people around you. And we see it when we go to the recruit schools, when we go to the training environments. The message for change has to be carried far and wide. It can't be left to women alone. It requires men to get on board, men to take action and encourage their peers to do likewise. So in summary, I think continuing the path of cultural reform will allow the Australian Defence Force to enjoy a strong and sustainable future. to secure a position as a first-class employer, which is what it wants to do, and to be an organisation where all its members, both men and women, can thrive. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Elizabeth Broderick, and just say also thanks to Clayton Lutz for the use of this fine facility this evening. And so we come to questions and discussion, and we've got to the top of the hour, so we've got plenty of time. I'll just lead off the very interesting paper. I think the figure you gave for sexual harassment in the Australian Defence Force is about the same, for women and men, is about the same in the general community, which probably surprises some people in view of the media coverage in the last couple of years. I think people would have thought it's probably higher. But if you go back to, say, the educational institutions, would it be greater there than it would be in a university or a tertiary college somewhere? And if it is about the same, why do you regard this as more, or do you regard this as more important if it occurs in the ADF than if it occurs in the university system or some other system equivalent? You come back here and I'll disappear over here. Yep.
No, it's a really good question, because I don't know of any other military in the world that has done an exercise where they've compared the military to the civilian organisation. So, and, you know, good on the leadership of the ADF that they were happy to put themselves up for that scrutiny. But you're right, in ADFA we see, you know, if you just run with the media reporting, you'll see a number of sex scandals that have emanated from ADFA. Now, do we know whether you're more likely to experience sexual harassment in ADFA than, say, any college at any of the universities around here? We don't have that comparative data. The only study that exists is one that was done by the National Union of Students, and it shows that sexual harassment is very high in residential colleges, in civilian universities, but the methodology was totally different, so we can't really compare. As to whether or not we should be more focused on the ADF, I suppose the ADF, and people will say this, it's held to a higher standard. And in a sense, that's as it should be, because it is a taxpayer-funded organisation, and it's an organisation that's representing us in global theatres of war. So it's taking Australia, you know, it's almost, in a sense, an ambassador for Australia. So those very high levels that the ADF is held to, I think the ADF itself would say are appropriate. Does that mean I'm not concerned about the incident of sexual assault, sexual harassment in residential colleges? No, I think that's something that needs to have a focus on it. And one of the things that came out of our review into ADFA was that ADFA developed a very strong benchmarking tool, which they're now rolling out through all their recruits and training schools in the ADF, so that they can at least get some benchmark data around sexual harassment, sexual assault, put in some targeted interventions and then remeasure. And I would be, you know, I'd really like to see a tool like that rolled out through residential colleges at universities, civilian universities across Australia.
There's a question here. Can you stay back where you are?
Do you know how the ADF compares to other forces in other countries in that sense? Is Australia different?
Look, we did quite a deal of comparative military analysis on militaries around the world, particularly looking at our coalition partners. Canada would probably seem to be leading the way in terms of women's representation in the military. Part of that is Canada has had women in combat-related roles for at least the last two decades. The US just opened up in the last few months. In fact, it was the Secretary for Defence, Leon Panettas, that was probably the last thing he did, was to open up every role to women in the US military. But there's no question that militaries around the world are all dealing with the issues of sexual harassment, sexual assault. And in fact, the US military, it may have been the Secretary of Defence, came out with their numbers. Reports of sexual misconduct, 26,000 reports annually. So, I mean, you know, the figures vary and from different organisations, different militaries, and they measure differently. You know, that's not necessarily rape, it might be something other than that. But I think you can say that, from my analysis, environments where the chain of command is an important part of the environment are ones where, sexual misconduct may be more deeply hidden, and that requires those organisations to have a very good look. And in fact, there's a global meeting of military ombudsmen, which is, I'll be presenting the work that's done in Australia, because with the implementation of these recommendations, Australia will be leading in a number of these areas.
There's a question here, then we go over there.
Do you have psychological tests that you give recruiters?
It's really interesting, because that's one of the things we looked at ADFA. And ADFA has a very kind of detailed recruitment process. So you've put through very many, many hurdles, including psychometric testing. But we're not actually testing as to whether or not people and new recruits fundamentally believe in gender equality. And I think that's potentially one of the things that I know the ADF are currently considering. Because just in my role as a sex discrimination commissioner, what we do know, particularly around violence against women, is that, and we know this from two national community attitude surveys that have been done, is, and here I'm looking at men's violence against women, but those men who fundamentally believe that men and women are equal, their propensity to commit violence against women is almost zero. So, you know, that's the community attitude we're trying to inculcate through our educational system, as well as, I think, through, you know, potentially through the recruitment of people into the ADF.
Can I suggest perhaps that the difference between women in the ADF and in an educational institution is that in an educational institution, the ratio of men to women is different, it's more similar, so there's more support. And the other thing that in a university a woman can go perhaps to the police. And my question is, if a woman in the ADF is not satisfied with the way her case was handled by the military, can she go to the civilian law enforcement agencies?
Yeah, in fact, here in Australia, so if it looks like it's a criminal offence, it will immediately be taken out to the police or the civilian authorities. I mean, that's very different between the US. In the US military, those matters are court-martialed within the military. So the level of transparency is very restricted. Whereas here in Australia, what's done is, if I was to report an incident, there'd be a quick assessment done, and then depending on the findings of that, it would be immediately transferred to the civilian police.
But you can go directly?
Yeah, you can go directly to the civilian police, absolutely, or to the rape crisis or whoever it is. And that's one of the things the ADF's done. It's started to form some good relationships with rape crisis and other organisations like that, so that women have a fast track there. But I take your point about the critical mass of women in co-ed colleges, residential colleges in civilian universities. The ADFA would have around 20%, 22% women, so it's not as low as more generally across the ADF, but it's a good point.
Fred Shaw.
Thanks very much, Elizabeth, for that. I'd be interested to hear a bit more about family-friendly policies you're advocating. A long time ago when I was in the military, one of the biggest problems for families was the constant posting of officers every 2 years. At most 3 years, you got posted maybe from Canberra to Townsville and then back again to Perth or whatever. That plus, how do you recruit submariners when you need to send them out, and other Navy people, particularly submariners, which was a shortage, when you need them to live in that very cramped environment and to go out for 6 month patrols, etc.
And you don't have the internet, because we've recently, which wasn't a problem before, it's a real problem to recruit Gen Y into submariners. Submariners are still, we can't get enough submariners in the ADF, so it's still a huge area where the recruitment is, you know, we don't have enough people. But you're right, family-friendly policies, and the posting cycles usually 3 years, but as you say, it can sometimes be as short as 2 years. Some of the things that are being tried at the minute as a result of some of these reform proposals is what they call recruit to area. So basically you can have two postings back to back in one area. So that might give you stability up to 6 years. And it shouldn't just be about women, that should also be about men. So that's one strategy that's being tried. There is a lot of informal, flexible work arrangements that exist in the ADF, but the fact is, unless they are formalised, they won't lead to a change in culture. And at the minute, the feeling is, oh, well, flexible works for women with babies, you know, not serious players. But if, when we talked about it before, flexible work is absolutely underpins capability. And the reason I say that is, as I said before, if Liz Broderick decides to leave the ADF when she's 30 to have a baby, we can't just bring someone else in. We have to grow another person from, you know, 15 years previously. So, you know, when we lose good talent because of lack of flexibility, that has not only a significant cost but an impact on capability. I think there's a growing recognition of that, and there will be some innovative strategies put in place to try and address that. But better childcare support. I mean, childcare is problematic. We all know that in Australia generally. If you're moving every 2 years and you're moving to environments where you don't have any family support, it becomes even more problematic. So there's some strategies that are happening there as well.
Question down there.
You've indicated the service chiefs are very open to you coming in and doing an investigation and to your recommendations. Why do you think they are so different to the culture that apparently grown out of?
So different to the culture.
The question is, why are the service chiefs different to the culture they allegedly have grown out of? They're very open, and I think the suggestion is you would think they wouldn't be open.
Yeah, you're right about that. And you know what? It's taken a bit of time, I have to say. I think part of it was actually understanding at an emotional level as well as an intellectual level the case for change. Hearing from people who, you know, had suffered in the military, whether it was suffered through sexual abuse or not being able to have a family or not being able to live the, you know, the expectations that they had around building a career in the ADF. So I think that shifted. When I see them out now talking on these issues, it comes from a place of caring about it, you know, through both head and heart, if I can put it that way. So I think personalising the case for change happened. And I think also a recognition strategically that if we want a high-performing organisation, if we want an organisation which can, you know, secure Australia's you know, security needs into the future or deliver effectively on those, we need to recruit from increased talent pools. And the ones we're recruiting from are shrinking. And unless we do something differently, it's just not going to be sustainable.
Squish down the back.
With the Try Before You Buy program, two things. Is it too early to know how successful that's been? And also, have they been taken up more by men or more by women over the people?
There's a question about the Try Before You Buy policy.
Yeah, and it's probably too early to say yet. What we know is a lot of women have been attracted to it. And if I can just give you an example of that, I spoke out at a school function last week, and the young girl who came to pick me up, who was their school captain, said she wanted to be a pilot. And I said, oh, fantastic, have you thought about the Air Force? She said, oh yeah, look, Mum and I looked at the Air Force, but the fact is I'd have to sign up for, and I think it's 12 years at the minute, and you know, I want to have a family and whatever, so we've kind of discounted that, and you know, we're going with it, seeing whether I can go with a commercial organisation. So I think that actually recognising that requesting women to sign up for those period of time will be a deterrent. So reducing through a Try Before You Buy, almost what they call a reduced imp. So I can go and I commit for a year, basically. And it's been a successful strategy. I don't have a hard data to tell you how successful, but we'll have that in the next few months.
Listening to all of this, it's very much the problem of all of our organisations to some extent because of lifestyle changes. Even the problem of partnerships. You know, how many are married to people within the services and how can they cope if they're not married to someone within the services. But to what extent do you have to be an Australian, live in Australia? What's our criteria around the kind of people we choose? I mean, we live in a global situation. Are we ever thinking of recruiting beyond Australia? Or how is it moving?
Yeah, I meet quite a number of recruits from militaries around the world.
Just how are they?
Yeah, but it's a really great point. We actually, I mean, I was in Staff College last week out at Western Creek and at the Centre for Defence Strategic Studies. A lot of the students that are there are from other nations. I think they might have had 18 different nations there, so all learning together or building strong links and leadership. So I think the Defence Force is definitely looking farther and wide. I know that people are regularly going to other militaries around the world and there is some quite deep connections. But you're right about who do defence women marry. Most defence women will marry defence men. most defence men will marry a civilian. That's often a case of numbers, but it's interesting when you look at the analysis. I have to say that we don't have a really hard data, but it's likely that the Defence Force has a higher separation or divorce rate than the general community. And when you look at that, often you meet people who have what's called a classification of married unattached. And wherever I go, often they're people who are married unattached. That means I'm married, but I haven't been living with my spouse because of my posting. I'm posted here and she's posted there. Or I'm posted here and she's a civilian living with a family back there. And I just think the strains often that those posting cycles put on individuals and the expectations that we have, that in some sense it is service before self, but also that you would give up what's essentially your basic human rights to serve in Australia's military. In one sense, it's so inspiring to see that. In another sense, I'm thinking, should anyone be asked to actually give up some of their basic human rights? And that's where I think, and that's why a lot of work's being done in this area now, which is the good news.
So we're getting towards the end. Have I missed anyone? No, I haven't missed anyone. So you put your report in, the main report last year,
mm-hmm.
and the other report this year.
Yes.
So what's next?
And then, so what's next is that we're currently, and we're off to HMAS Stirling tomorrow in to look, talk to submariners and submarines and off to the big base across in Western Australia. So we're now going to look at what impact the recommendations have had. Firstly, have they been implemented and how well? And secondly, what impact are they having? So towards the middle or the end of the first quarter of next year, there will be a final report. One of the other things is that we are having an ongoing relationship with the ADF. So the ADF has asked us to have a continuing role with them, because I think part of it is having some external eyes, someone who actually goes into organisations all over Australia around these issues can be very helpful when you're trying to move forward on a cultural change agenda. So that's pretty much where we're at.
Many thanks,
Chief. Thanks. Thanks very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.